If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. My guest today is Garrett Nyman. He has a BA in economics from Stanford, an MBA from Harvard Business School, and a master's in public policy from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He was a founding CEO of College Spring, a national college access nonprofit, a co-creator of Liberation Ventures, a philanthropic fund focused on building power toward reparations, a senior fellow at Prosperity Now, and an adjunct lecturer at the Stanford Center on Poverty and Inequality. He's also the author of the recently released book, Rich White Men: What It Takes to Uproot the Old Boys Club and Transform America, which we'll be talking about today. Garrett Nyman, welcome to the show.
Really happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Mike.
So I thought I'd start with what seems like an obvious question. What's the problem with rich white men?
I appreciate you asking. The way I see it is a little bit different. From my perspective, you know, even as somebody who wrote a book called Rich White Men, I see it less as an issue about rich white men as individuals or even as a group, and more of an issue of what happens when power is severely concentrated in society. And the critique I offer in the book is really about the extent to which power is concentrated in the United States and how that power is being wielded currently.
Yeah, and I think just from a book title perspective, concentration of power in the United States, it doesn't really grab you the same way that rich white men does. So there's that. But, you know, and I think when we focus on issues of inequality and oftentimes the issues of racism or race that go along with them, on a bipartisan show like this, I'm positive that a number of listeners are thinking something along the lines of, yeah, okay, there's inequality, there's racism, but let's not just focus on now, let's look back. And haven't things gotten significantly better? And so is there really a problem here? Or is the real problem that there are people who want to sort of force change at a faster pace than society might be willing to go along with or might be able to even cope with?
Absolutely. It's a good question and one that comes up often, that America is an interesting place that in some ways we've had extraordinary progress, and in other ways, you know, things have very much stayed the same. So, for example, you know, having a country that went from slavery to Jim Crow to the Civil Rights Movement, you know, those are massive shifts. Granted, they took centuries, but those are massive shifts for a country to make over time. And then on the other hand, it's also true that the typical Black American in this country still holds very, very much close to zero wealth. You know, and that's a reality that has been stagnant for 400 years. You know, so it's this interesting mix of a country where in some ways there's real progress, but when you've looked at who has economic power in this country, and in American capitalism, economic power is really important. Folks like Black Americans have largely been left out of that, and that has continued since the 60s. And the only other thing I wanted to mention about this question about the rapidity of change is that we're actually at a moment where change is happening extremely fast. Like when I think about things like globalization, automation, the internet, social media, augmented reality, AI, these are massive, very fast shifts that society is experiencing. And basically what I call for in the book is that the notion that we need to be more cautious about rapid change that lines the pocketbooks of rich white men and more open-minded to fast-paced change that doesn't have that same impact for rich white men.
I think when you talk about caution, about rapid change, there's a part of my sort of Burkean soul that lights up at that. Although I would probably go a little further than you, even though politically I certainly am a person of the left. And I guess maybe more to that point, do you think that folks who say any sort of rapid change, whether it's for things that we think are, or we even believe in our hearts are good, carries with it a certain element of risk, and that we need to balance sort of the carrying capacity of a society to deal with change, regardless of whether it, lines rich white men's or anyone's pockets or not, with the potential good it can do or the potential harm for moving too quickly, that sort of concern about hubris?
Absolutely. I mean, there's definitely wisdom in the notion that having a society metabolize change, there's value in that idea, there's value in that approach. And it's very much the case that there are changes that historically in this country have made many Americans uncomfortable in the moment, but in retrospect end up being some of our proudest moments. So for example, in the 60s, the approval rate for Dr. King was similar to the approval rating for the Black Lives Matter movement leading up to 2020. Ultimately, the country now looks back on Dr. King's contributions as someone who made an enormous positive difference in this country. So there's also this pattern of, changes that make people uncomfortable in the moment, but later they look on proudly. And so I think we need to balance that out, that there's something to be said for making people a little bit uncomfortable, in the pursuit of change that ultimately they embrace.
Yeah, another maybe way of approaching this, at least from the right, is that let's say even on equality, at least putting racism to the side, which is a big thing to put to the side, but even if inequality is rising, and sure seems to me that by a lot of measures it is, even so, life in a lot of ways is getting better for almost everyone. I mean, people at almost all income levels have access to astounding technology, smartphones, entertainment that even the wealthiest people of half a century ago, or even a couple generations ago, didn't have, because, of course, those technologies didn't exist, and this is the system that built them. And so I think the argument is basically, to sum it up, is, well, there's a rising tide that's really lifting almost all the boats, and so does it really matter if some of those boats are lifted significantly higher than others? And I wanted to get your take on that.
It's absolutely a fair question, and I think it's something that a lot of people are curious about and pay attention to. I think my main take on it is that I would argue that the rising tide isn't lifting all boats in the way that that many describe. That Matthew Desmond has some good text on this in his new book on poverty that came out in March, where he makes the point that while certain luxuries have become more acceptable to a greater number of people, things like televisions, computers, smartphones, and so forth have been democratized to an extent, that the basics that humans need to survive, food, water, shelter, healthcare, that for many low and middle income Americans, they're spending a higher and higher percentage of their incomes on their basic needs, which means that their basic needs are actually becoming less accessible. And I think about places like New Mexico, where, 30% of the indigenous population doesn't have access to clean water. That wasn't the case pre-colonization 500 years ago. So there are concrete ways that, at least for some people in this country, things are worse than they were centuries ago. That's not to minimize progress, technological innovations, and so forth. But I do think we need to be really clear about the fact that if basic needs are becoming less accessible, that's a big problem, because it's hard to enjoy a Netflix show if you're starving.
I was just thinking, if I had to choose between clean water and availability of healthcare and Hulu or something like that, I think I'd go with the first two, though. It might be difficult at some point. But
me too.
There are other people who would say, okay, there are some problems, some real problems, but to a large extent, they believe, or they would argue, that they're related to things like dysfunctional families or work ethic, cultural attitudes even of certain groups. Basically, I think the idea is that if you're not succeeding in a meritocratic society, more often than not, it's going to be not, we shouldn't be blaming the system, but we should be looking at those individuals and say, hey, maybe you didn't work hard enough, or maybe you gave up too quickly, or something else. And I wanted to get your response to people who oftentimes would you know, have views like that of our current situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way I think about this is that, as I understand it, the debate about equity in this country, which really has been a debate that's been ongoing for 400 years, is this question about, you know, does discrimination explain disparities? And so, you know, that there's, you know, on the left, you know, there's at least a portion of the left that would say that if we're talking about anti-Black racism, for example, that historical and contemporary discrimination fully explains disparities, whereas others would say that explains some of it, or some folks might even say not any of it any longer. And the way I think about this is that if you're going to make a claim that a group is genetically inferior, or culturally inferior, or behaviorally inferior, the burden of proof really falls on you in an extreme way, because that's a very dangerous claim to make. And I don't actually think there's a lot of evidence that those claims have merit, that there's been so many audit studies that show how people experience discrimination in a variety of settings. There's so many studies that show that there's unconscious bias in addition to conscious bias that people have. And so if we're not totally clear that discrimination doesn't explain the disparities, I think the default we need to operate under is that they do. And my argument for why discrimination does explain disparities is through a concept I coined in the book called compounding under an advantage, which is this notion that seemingly small identity-based under an advantages, when they show up in key moments in people's lives, they change trajectories. You know, so when I didn't pass the gifted exam in second grade, but there's a district workaround that led me to be labeled gifted, that changed the entire trajectory of my life, that it put me on track for AP courses in Stanford and everything that came afterward. And I know that there's people of color in this country who wouldn't have been given the benefit of the doubt and extra help I was given to be put on that path. You know, so it really doesn't take that extreme of discrimination to produce large disparities in our society. So I think there's actually a pretty compelling case that discrimination does explain disparities.
And I would think that that would be particularly true earlier on in life, with things like early life healthcare and family security and educational opportunities and that sort of thing. And that the earlier that would happen, the more of a knock-on effect you'd be likely to see later on.
Absolutely. And I know someone, for example, who, you know, started a national nonprofit that's focused on getting eyeglasses to elementary school kids in high poverty communities of color. And that's great. But I think it also begs the question, like, why is it the case that families don't have the financial resources or government assistance to afford glasses so that their students can see the board during class? That I think if we're not ensuring that people's basic needs are being met in this way, we're not going to be able to close the gaps that are out there.
You know, I feel like sometimes people on both kind of the extremes of the left and the right maybe oversimplify the causality. Here on the right, I tend to hear, well, it's all or almost all about personal decisions and that sort of thing. And that's always wrong, false to me, or for most of my life. But on the left, too, I think there's this similar thing, but just to coin the reverse of it, saying that, well, it's all racism, it's all systematic. And I wonder if there's a way to, because I understand the notion to say, well, we don't want to start talking about personal responsibility because then that's all some people are going to focus on. But I can't help but feel that if we can in some way, those of us on the left, acknowledge that, sure, personal responsibility and choices can play a role, but overall, they're likely not to be the largest thing, that might lead to better engagement and a more fruitful conversation with people. And I wonder what you think about that.
Absolutely. It's something that I've thought a lot about, because I think it can be a real barrier for dialogue, that if those of us who have progressive views on the issue of race don't make those acknowledgments that you mentioned, I think that it can spark that response. And, you know, I believe that that everyone in this country has some degree of agency, some ability to influence their life. To what degree very much varies based on that person's circumstances, but I think it's indisputable that every human being has some level of agency in this country. And so the tricky part, as I understand it, becomes when we start talking about personal responsibility in the context of certain groups are less responsible than other groups. That's something that I interpret as a racist idea, which is different than saying that, you know, some individuals make better choices than others. If you say that some groups make better choices than others, to me, that moves into racist territory.
Right. Or at least, even if someone is trying to make a distinction and talk about groups, it can sure come off as a dog whistle sort of thing to folks who do hold avowedly racist views, which, you know, certainly isn't something that I would like to see, and I'm sure you wouldn't either.
Yeah.
You know, so we're talking a lot about race and inequality, and those two things, oftentimes, I think to many of us on the left, they seem very tightly intertwined. But, you know, when I've talked about inequality and race on the podcast before, as I have a number of times with Jay, who's my conservative co-host, he tends to argue that, you know, largely what a lot of progressives see as racism is much more of a socioeconomic issue. And so why that's important is that what we need to do is focus less on race and more on improving economic opportunity for everyone, things like empowerment zones and other things like that. And if we do that, a lot of what we think wrongly are racial problems will, if not go away, at least be minimized. And I wanted to get your reaction to that, because I'm sure you've heard that argument before.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is, as I understand it, the issue of race and socioeconomic status is very much intertwined in this country. And I think what some people forget is that until the 60s, race was class. That we had a formal hierarchy in big parts of this country that said that if you were Black, you were part of a lower class status than if you were white. You know, so it was really not until the Civil Rights Movement could we even have a discussion about whether race and socioeconomic issues, you know, are different. You know, it just had been fundamentally the case, pretty much categorically, that there was a Black underclass in this country. And so if that's your starting point in the 60s, you know, to me, it's going to be obvious that those issues are going to remain intertwined. You know, that the poorest communities in this country, for example, are Black, Indigenous, and Latinx predominantly communities. And so, like, when we look at the issue of concentrated poverty, that really is a Black, Indigenous, people of color experience. Obviously, there's exceptions like Appalachia and so forth. But for the most part, you know, those unique characteristics of an underclass of folks who both don't have financial resources themselves and who are part of communities that don't have those financial resources is predominantly a people of color experience. The only other thing I would say on this is I think part of why I bristle when folks on the right talk about, oh, it's a socioeconomic issue and not a racial issue, is that I also don't feel like there's much recognition that this country and certainly on the right has done very much to level the playing field for those who are in poverty, regardless of their race, that social mobility in this country is dramatically down. And in my analysis, a lot of that has to do with how those who hold high levels of wealth are taking intentional measures to protect that wealth and power that they hold. So I don't see the right doing a whole lot for people in poverty. And frankly, I don't really see that from the bulk of the Democratic Party either, that there's a willingness to ignore that population, regardless of race, in addition to pressure to not talk about race either.
Well, I guess they're not the people who donate the big bucks to campaigns and so forth. And I think that makes a real difference.
Oh, absolutely. That's a major tension point. And I think that's, you know, fundamentally, this book is an argument for, you know, why this country needs to have lower inequality, that when there's high inequality in a country, you know, what ends up happening is that there's elite capture. So the wealth holders influence the political system, but also they engage in what economists call rent seeking, which is basically extracting profit that doesn't have any benefit for society. They could think hiring a bunch of accountants to lower your corporate tax bill, for example. So the higher inequality is, the more incentive there is for elites to hoard that wealth and power, and the less incentive there is for everybody else to bring their creativity, energy, and gifts to the table. Because if a country doesn't have high social mobility, and the U.S. no longer has that, it's hard to feel confident or optimistic that if you go the extra mile, that it's going to yield anything meaningful for you or your family.
We haven't talked about gender yet, and I think this also plays in. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, how you see things like our current gender norms, gender roles, stereotypes, that sort of thing, as playing into our issues that we have with inequality at present.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the way I talk about it in Rich White Men is that there's having unearned advantages associated with being male in ways that in many ways are similar to how those compounding unearned advantages show up if you're white or if you grow up in a wealthy family. And so when we look at how there is bias that favors men, you know, and diminishes women, so for example, there's all these studies that show that that people of both genders typically believe that that men are quote more better leadership material or more likable. All of these things show up in subtle ways that impact the trajectories of people's lives and ultimately produce large disparities. So you could have a company that at an entry level, you know, is 50-50 gender-wise. But at each level, you're going to see a subtle decrease in women until you get to the top of organizations, companies. You're going to see very few women at the top. That's a similar pattern to, you know, what we see for race or socioeconomic status, that eventually those advantages and disadvantages compound in ways that lead to the most powerful people in society continuing to be almost always rich white men, regardless of the circumstances that they grow up in.
Now, unlike with race, though, I mean, there are some sort of clear differences with gender, right? And so I think some people would certainly say, well, yeah, there are fewer women maybe at these positions of power because it's not men that can get pregnant and have kids. And then there's the argument about, well, maternal instincts, and not saying that fathers don't have them, but that this in part is explainable by some very real biological differences. And do you think there's something to that?
Well, it's very complicated and it's dicey territory. I think what I would say is that it's possible for people to have different roles in society, but for the power they experience still to be equitable. So, like, for example, in the Haudenosaunee tribe before colonization, there was a system where this was hundreds of years ago, where it was still the case that the men were the chiefs, but all of the judges were women, and The women held veto power over whether the country went to war. That it's the metaphor in the U.S. context might be something like having a male president while having an entirely female Senate and Supreme Court. You know, so there's ways that a society can put in checks and balances so that even if people have different roles, it doesn't mean that their voice is marginalized or oppressed. And that's just not what has happened in this country. What has happened in this country is this notion that that if you're someone who cares for children, which is one of the, you know, the most important things humanity needs to survive and thrive, that's actually justification for you having less power in society. So that's how I think about it.
I think maybe this is a good point to bring up intersectionality. And for a lot of folks on the left, it's a term we're fairly familiar with. But my guess is that in sort of wider society, maybe people aren't even clear about what the term means in the first place and why they should care about it. And I think this definitely plays into this. So can you maybe first talk a little bit about what your sense of intersectionality is and why you felt it was important enough to focus an entire chapter of your book on intersectionality and issues related to it?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a chapter that explicitly focuses on it. And in many ways, the entire book about rich white men is very much focused on intersectionality. And as many of your listeners may know, you know, the history of that term was Kimberly Crenshaw looking at it from a legal lens that it was possible that there could be a company that was discriminating against women in certain roles and Black people in certain roles, that like even if they weren't discriminating against those groups, it was still possible for them to discriminate against Black women specifically. So it very much arose out of this legal context. I think what has emerged in the decades since is this notion that intersectional identities matter and are important. And I think because you know, white men haven't been, not that many white men have been engaged on the topic of intersectionality, that I think people often associate it with being intersectionally oppressed, you know, whether it's Black women or Latinx women and so non-binary folks and so forth. But the reality is that every one of us has an intersectional identity. Rika Sen talks about this in her work, that it really is the case that an intersectional identity is just the various combinations of identities that we hold. And every one of us has a whole bunch of these, you know. So I am white and male, and I grew up in a wealthy family. I'm straight, I'm Jewish. You know, you could go, you know, build a much longer list than that. And so every one of these identities has some impact on my lived experience in this country. And that combination of identities is actually unique. You know, so intersectionality is actually a way of recognizing that every one of us has a unique experience and has something unique to contribute. But we have to acknowledge those differences in order to celebrate that uniqueness, that if we actually deny it, you know, then we're not able to tap into the brilliance of everyone's unique lived experience.
But I guess from a public policy perspective or public understanding perspective, that also can make it difficult to grasp, because if we can frame things in terms of, well, here's a problem with rich people or with males or something like that, that seems to me inherently easier to kind of grab onto than saying, well, you know, we all have maybe a half a dozen or more kind of key identities and a whole lot more than that. And things get pretty messy pretty quickly. And I think a lot of folks are uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, I can understand where they're coming from. And I think that the reality is that not wading into that complexity actually is one of the key strategies that rich white men in this country use to maintain power. That if you look at how power is structured around the world, you have, you know, in India has the caste system with a handful of castes. South Africa have three racial identities. The U.S. has a handful. You know, the Western world uses the gender binary that all of these are both simple categorizations they only work if they're very easy to identify, and most of the population follows specific norms about how to treat people who have those identity characteristics, so that when we start recognizing that all of us have very complex identities, that it actually becomes impossible to treat people in as discriminatory of a way. So I think a big part of how we transcend a culture of systems of oppression is actually celebrating everyone's unique identity.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. Yeah, I've brought up rich white male advantage a lot. Well, maybe not a lot, but more than a few times on the podcast in the past. And I'll have these conversations with Jay, and I'll kind of regularly point out, hey, you know, by the way, we elected a black man president of the United States, not once, but twice, and by comfortable margins. And that, you know, Michelle Obama was a couple of years ago named the most admired woman in America. And look at, I mean, Oprah Winfrey, for God's sake. And you know, there are 3 non-whites, 4 women on the Supreme Court. The current vice president is a black woman, and you know, so on. You could go on and on and on. And that's exactly Jay's point. And he's, I think, speaking for a lot of folks on the right who look at this and these arguments and say, well, if society is so racist and sexist and all these issues, how are all these women and people of color succeeding at the very highest levels? And I wanted to get your take on that.
Yeah, it's definitely a topic that gets a lot of play. And I think one of the things that I want to emphasize is that that when you look at who holds the most power in this country, that not only are white women and people of color underrepresented, but they're actually dramatically more underrepresented than I think many elites claim. You know, so yes, we have those exceptions out there, but it also, you know, if you look at who holds power in finance and technology, for example, which are the primary ways to build a lot of wealth in this country, that those are very white male dominated professions. And if you go down the Forbes list, that I remember going through this on the site, that I had to go through dozens and dozens and dozens of white men before I found a single person of color. And the person I found was a Chinese American man who actually made his fortune in China. And then you go down even further, you know, eventually you find Oprah Winfrey hundreds down, you know, so that yes, there are these exceptions, but also, like, this is not a country where, you know, the very wealthiest people, the Bill Gateses, Warren Buffetts, Elon Musk of the world, those are all women. So when you look at who holds the most capital in society and the greatest ability to shape the direction of the country, that's a group that actually is, pretty much exclusively white men. And again, there's exceptions, but I think, what ends up being the case, particularly in business and in capitalism, capital is a source of power. That almost always rich white men end up on top.
But we'd also, right, expect something of a generation or two lag effect. I mean, I could see a counter argument saying, like, yeah, there's no questioning that we had some really serious problems with racism and sexism in the up to the 1960s and 1970s, even. I would find it hard to argue against that. But building this sort of generational wealth and generational advantages, well, that takes time. I mean, Elon Musk was born in 1971, I think, which means his dad was born, you know, probably, I guess, sometime in the 40s or something like that. And so maybe this is just part of the process and we just need to be patient and kind of let the process unfold. I got a feeling you wouldn't be entirely satisfied with that kind of response.
Yeah, absolutely. And one term we haven't brought up yet is like this notion of tokenism. And I remember, one of the people who I talked to along the way of writing this book is someone who's a former cabinet member for a recent Democratic president. And, you know, that he, you know, when I told him that I was focused on, you know, issues of equity related to my career, he really bristled at that and, you know, seemed to think that that was a waste of time or maybe even problematic. And, you know, I remember saying to him, like, well, what about, you know, what about your president's cabinet that had more diversity than, you know, other cabinets previously? Didn't that, you know, help the president make better decisions for the country? And what he, you know, what he said was, he's like, look, those were mostly B and C players selected for political reasons. And so you have this rich white man who's in the room with these cabinet officials, you know, who he should have been thinking of as peers, you know, but he still has this condescending notion that he's superior to those folks, you know, and that's a view that, frankly, I think is commonly held among rich white men, so that even when white women and people of color land powerful posts, they're not necessarily treated with the same level of respect and dignity that other white men are. We see this on the Supreme Court, where male Supreme Court justices interrupt female Supreme Court justices, you know, two or three times as often as they interrupt each other. You know, so there's this culture of that white women and people of color are inferior to rich white men. And it's challenging to break that culture. And certainly having more white women and people of color in leadership positions is a step toward that. But it doesn't wipe out that culture all at once by any means.
Yeah, you know, I've certainly heard a lot of that myself. But I think generally speaking, when I ask people about, they'd say something like, well, that's because I know that this person didn't have to meet the same standards I did, whether it was law school admissions or something like that, or at least there's suspicion that that might be the case. And so I certainly could see from the perspective, if you feel that somebody landed in a position without demonstrating the prerequisites that you had to demonstrate, that it might be reasonable to say, well, are they every bit as good if they didn't have to demonstrate the same worthiness, I guess, for lack of a better word? It seems to me that's one of the arguments we hear on the right. And I wonder, do you think there's something to that?
It certainly is one of the arguments. I think the way I see it is that I experienced that argument as a fundamentally broken way of looking at our other human beings. So for example, like when I think about, you know, the case of, you know, the president's cabinet and this notion, this one cabinet member's notion that, you know, he's superior to the other cabinet members, maybe for the reasons that you describe, that's a specific way of looking at human value and worth. You know, that same man could have had a perspective that was like, oh, this person has a different journey, different lived experiences, different perspectives than my own, and therefore they're an equally important voice in this conversation, not a more important voice, but an equally important voice. And so, you know, this notion that there's specific measures of, quote, merit, you know, which are all measures that rich white men design and control, and that those are the only ways to measure a value of a human being is a fundamentally problematic notion that I disagree with.
Yeah, I guess I would also add to that when people talk about unearned advantages for things like admission scores and so forth, they often don't think about the unearned advantage of wealth, and that if you had a family that allowed you to get an expensive, fancy test prep service or put you into the best schools or something, those are unearned advantages too, but that tends not to come into the comp. We tend to forget the unearned advantages that help us, and we tend to focus on those that help maybe not us, I guess. At least that's my experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And a really good example of this is legacy admissions.
Yeah.
You know, that many of the rich white men in power, you know, were admitted to universities, at least in part because of their family ties, which is very much linked to family wealth and race. You know, but, you know, most of the mainstream dialogue in affirmative action is about race, not legacy admissions. You know, so, you know, that I do think there's something about you know, many rich white men believing that they're the top of the pile and therefore are uniquely equipped to judge who meets their bar, instead of actually looking at all human beings as equals. And, you know, for me, like, I try to do this even with my son, who's a toddler, that there's so many things that, you know, he's taught me. There's ways that he's connected to his, you know, intuition, his wonder for the world, that I've forgotten or was socialized out of me. So, you know, I try to come into every interaction with every human being believing that there's something I can learn, something that they have value, wisdom they uniquely hold. And I think if more rich white men took that approach, I think they'd find that white women and people of color have a lot more to offer than they currently credit them.
So, you know, even let's say if someone agrees, you know, there are systemic inequalities in American society. I think there are still plenty of people would say, even so, you don't end discrimination by discriminating. You know, this reverse discrimination, sometimes they'll say, well, it's unjust. You can even argue it's unconstitutional, depending on how you view the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And that really what we should be shooting for is a colorblindness. A lot of times they'll talk about that line from Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, right? That my four little children will one day live in a nation where they be not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I think that resonates with a lot of folks. And I wanted to get your reaction to that.
Absolutely. It's definitely a question that comes up a lot. And I think I would not dispute in the slightest the notion that, that vision that Dr. King outlines is, you know, the aspiration I'm hoping for in this country. The question is, like, how do we get there as a nation? And is it possible to level the playing field that has been dramatically unlevel, you know, without trying to level it in some way? When I think about issues like reparations, for example, you know, reparations in many ways, you know, is something that's very much focused on the past and remedies for the past, but it's also about the future, that it's about this country making a claim that it believes in the potential of Black people and that everyone in this country, including Black people, deserves capital so that they can succeed in the American capitalist system that we have. You know, so I really think that there's no way around it, that if you want to try to close massive racial disparities, that there's no way to do that without having race-based policies. And so when folks advocate for a colorblind approach, you know, but what that ends up producing in practice is just perpetuating the status quo as it currently stands, which is very unequal racially.
I'm glad you mentioned reparations, because it's become, I guess, much more of a thing. Not too long ago, we had in California, they have a reparations task force that approved some recommendations on state compensation. There's talk that, you know, there could be cash payments of over $1 million per person. And I mean, there have been all kinds of cost estimates, and, you know, the legislature will do whatever it does, but this could cost, in some estimates, hundreds of billions of dollars. And so I wanted to get your take. I guess you talked a little bit about reparations in general, but sometimes the problem can be trying to find an implementation, even if you agree with the theory. And I expect you've at least thought, you've seen a little bit about California's plan. Can you speak to that and what you think, and maybe more broadly, how you think reparations might best be structured, I guess, maybe is the way to put it?
Sure. So this is an issue that I've spent a lot of time on directly as a co-creator of Liberation Ventures, which is a philanthropic fund focused on building power toward the reparations movement. It's also a topic that I discuss at length in Rich White Men. That one of the concepts I talk about in the book is this notion of generating a culture of repair, which is something my colleagues, Ari and Alan, have worked on a lot at Liberation Ventures. And it's this notion that, you know, that if some harm has been done, you know, that I want to live in a society that repairs that. I don't want to live in a society that sweeps that under the rug. And, you know, the United Nations has very clear standards for what types of harms qualify for reparations. The United States is very much a textbook case for it, related to anti-Black racism and slavery in particular. And it's also the case that this country has provided reparations before, that it's provided reparations to Japanese Americans who were in internment camps. It's provided reparations to victims of police torture in Chicago. There's, you know, so there's a whole, you know, the whole history of this country providing financial remediation, you know, in instances of harm. And so, you know, when I think about America as a capitalist system, that capital is a source of power, a central source of power. And I don't see how anyone could argue that we offer equal opportunity in this country across racial lines if Black people don't have the same access to capital that white folks do. And so, you know, closing the racial wealth gap, you know, if we're serious about equal opportunity, I think is something that needs to happen. And, you know, the racial wealth gap is about $11 trillion. It's a big number. You know, Dr. Sandy Darity in his book, he talks about how, you know, if you did that a trillion a year over a decade, that's about 5% of GDP. It's a similar scale to the Marshall Plan, but also it's not just an expense, it's an investment that if this country, you know, invests in racial healing, if it invests in creating a new social contract with Black Americans, if it invests in Black people, you know, all of those investments will pay dividends for our democracy, our economy and society more widely. And, you know, the government, whether it's city, state, federal, is a blunt instrument. You know, but I think if we're going to try to take on something as massive as the racial wealth gap and systemic racism in this country, you do need, you know, one or more big levers like reparations to really move the needle.
I certainly am sympathetic to that argument, but I guess I wonder if reparations are the right way to approach it. I mean, you mentioned some other instances in which we have done reparations, but it seems to me that after so many generations, it raises the complexity enormously. And I wonder if that's just a bad way to frame it. And it might not be better to kind of not frame things in such a way where a lot of folks could say, well, you're focusing on the past and what do, I don't know, six or seven generations, you know, removed from that have to, what's the linkage, as opposed to focusing on present day issues and not kind of linking things back to that. I don't know. It seems like a big muddle to me. But obviously you think reparations are worth spending a lot of time on as a concept. And so maybe you can kind of help me out with this.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, reparations is about the past, the present and the future. And I won't belabor the past here, given your question, you know, so when I think about where we are now in the future, the main thing I think about here is the racial wealth gap. And systemic racism is more complex than the racial wealth gap. And, you know, that addressing systemic racism is more complex than writing a check. You know, but the question I always ask folks is, you know, that the racial wealth gap is something that we have right now. So regardless of how we got here and what you may or may not think is our moral responsibility for that history, what are we going to do about this $11 trillion gap now? That if we are going to say this country offers equal opportunity to Black people, how do we close that gap? And I personally have not seen any proposals that take a big bite out of that gap that don't have some redistributive component. They can take different forms. You know, maybe it's housing vouchers for Black families who don't have to pay a down payment, or it's forgiving student loans, or, you know, there's other ways to look at it than direct cash. But I don't see any path to closing that kind of gap without some sort of redistributive policy. And it's the case that the racial wealth gap is growing, that it's grown since the 60s, even with civil rights reforms. It's grown in Democratic administrations in addition to Republican ones. And so the least expensive time to close the racial wealth gap is actually today, that gap is compounding. So it's only going to be more and more expensive for this country to address racial inequity at some later point.
Do you think it's problematic in some ways to focus on the wealth gap or inequality through a race lens? Because I'm thinking, when you mentioned policies, I'm thinking about a lot of policies or potential policies that would certainly address inequality, but would apply to, well, if you're a poor white in Eastern Kentucky or a poor, you know, a poor Black person in downtown Cincinnati, what have you. And I wonder if policies that focused more strictly on that socioeconomic piece and not bring in race could both get more buy-in and potentially have a positive effect on more Americans? Or is do you think there is a compelling reason to make at least part of the focus on race?
Absolutely. It's a big question. And I think there's a, from my perspective, there's a both and here. So like, for example, we talked a little bit earlier about the issue of concentrated poverty, you know, which I mentioned is something that Black and Brown folks disproportionately experience compared to white folks. But there's still, I think, something in the neighborhood of 3-4 million white people who live in concentrated poverty in this country that I would be fully supportive of. And I mentioned, you know, some of these policy ideas in Rich White Men. You know, what does it look like for us to make major and major federal government Marshall Plan style investments in high poverty communities across the country, regardless of race? What does it look like for us to provide universal health care regardless of race? You know, so there's a number of policies that I think are very much supportive of this country becoming more equitable for everyone, including folks of color that are not race-based. And it's the case that for Black and Indigenous populations in particular, they've seen a lot of policies that were intended to be universalist not deliver benefits for their community specifically, whether it's you know, Black folks being left out of the GI Bill or, you know, exclusions being in place, that there's all this history of, you know, policies that are, quote, intended for everyone, but somehow don't end up benefiting Black and Indigenous communities in the same way or even at all. So fundamentally, there's, you know, a lot of distrust that people of color feel that policies that are not race-based will actually deliver the outcomes that are intended. And so when I think about a policy like reparations, that a lot of it is establishing a new social contract with people of color in this country, saying, look, you know, that we, you know, we've struggled in the past to offer equal opportunity and equity for people in this country across racial lines, and we're committed to doing things differently. That if we don't restore that trust in this country, we're not going to have racial healing, even if we have some universalist policies that may or may not deliver outcomes for communities of color.
Got it. So, in other words, as part of sort of a Marshall Plan on inequality, it would be, when you talk about a both and, it would be maybe specifically targeted things like reparations, along with more universalist things like universal health care. And I would hope for some pretty significant changes to how we do work education in this country and things like that, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I, you know, I think one of the things that speaks so strongly to how these systems of oppression function is that if you're a wealthy white woman, or you're a wealthy Black man, or you're a white man in poverty, you feel oppressed in this country. That's what, you know, at least I can't generalize, but, you know, that's what many, many white women and people of color have told me, that even if they have some of these advantage identity markers, if you're even missing a single one, they end up feeling oppressed, you know. So we really do need to look at these holistically and take on the different elements. Because if you're a white man living in poverty, this is a tough country to live in, and that there needs to be remedy for that. But that doesn't negate that racial discrimination still exists.
You know, I got to wonder as we wind down, it occurred to me, you mentioned that, you know, you came from a comfortable background and obviously you went to some very good schools and that sort of thing. And so I wonder, on one hand, I could hear people, at least from the left, saying, oh, God, it's a rich white man trying to tell us how to solve problems with his group. How much faith should we put on that? On the other hand, I could hear people saying, well, he's speaking against his own interests, so maybe there's something to that. I don't know. What kind of, have you gotten both of those reactions, either of those reactions, or what?
Oh, absolutely. Definitely gotten both of those reactions. And it's a challenging place to play in, because, you know, on the one hand, the equity movement, it really is about centering voices that have not been historically centered. But at the same time, we also need privileged folks to step up and advocate for change within their communities. And it's it's a messy, complicated process, which is why I've gotten both of those reactions that you mentioned. And I think the way I've come down on this over time is this notion that it's not necessarily problematic for me to use my voice, which is an exercise of power. I think the question is, what steps are being taken to use that power accountably? And so, for example, in my case, that I worked with Alan Kwabena Frimpong, who's a movement philanthropy consultant and strategist, to design a royalties cooperative for this book. So social justice organizations are receiving 86% of what would have been my author royalties in exchange for serving as accountability partners for this project, meaning that they offer guidance, perspective, they ultimately have the right to criticize me publicly if they so choose, that wouldn't have any impact on whether they receive royalties. So we have tried to put this structure in place where I acknowledge that me using my voice in this way could potentially impact the lives of white women and people of color. And so therefore, there's a need for me to operate within an accountability structure where I'm accountable for that impact that I'm having. And that doesn't mean I won't ever make mistakes, but that if I do make mistakes, those partners are gonna push me to be aware of them and ultimately repair them. And I think that's an example of what accountable power can look like. That's very different than a white man going onto a podcast saying whatever they want, regardless of how people are impacted.
And certainly taking responsibility and accountability, I mean, those are bedrock conservative values. And so you would think at least on that level, there would be some, at least if not buy-in, appreciation on the right for how you've set things up and so forth.
Perhaps. We'll see.
All right. I know that we're running out of time, but one last thing, because I'd like to end on a positive note, if possible. So tell me at least one thing that makes you feel at least somewhat positive, somewhat optimistic about the future of inequality, racial, gender, wealth in America.
Sure. I think this may be random, but I'm going to go all the way back to the 1600s, that in Ibram Kendi's Stamp in the Beginning, he talks about how the Mennonites, which are a sect of Christianity, were passing out abolitionist pamphlets in the 1600s, almost 200 years before slavery was ultimately abolished. And, when I think about, the work that I and others are doing on social justice today, that I think I'm sure in the 1600s, it felt nearly unimaginable to the Mennonites that slavery would eventually end. And those who were passing out those pamphlets didn't even see that change happen in their lifetimes. But with further organizing, activism, collectivism, those changes eventually happened. And so, that's, one of the examples that really motivates me is that the notion that, in the long-term time horizon, major structural and cultural changes are possible. And I try to stay focused on the long view and hopeful about the long view, and know that there's been people in this country from the very beginning who've been fighting for a just America and succeeding, even if it's taken longer in some cases than many of us would have hoped.
Or I guess going back to Dr. King, as he said, right, the arc of the immoral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And let's certainly hope so. And that is an optimistic note to close on. Garrett Nyman, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this Politics Guys interview. And if you did, we'd really appreciate it if you could mention us on social media or however else you share things you like. It would also be great if you could rate and review us on your podcast app. If you got a question, comment, correction, gripe, manifesto, whatever, you want to share it with us, you can reach us a bunch of ways. mail@politicsguys.com, as well as there's our supporters exclusive Discord channel, and we're also on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to become a supporter of the show, you can find out more about that at patreon.com/politicsguys or politicsguys.com/support. And links to all that are always in our show notes. The executive producers of The Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, and Ryan Beasley. We'll be back with a new episode this coming weekend. We hope you'll join us.